Support for this podcast comes from the UTSA Institute of Texan Cultures, telling stories of Texas history and heritage from diverse cultures that define the state's unique character for over 50 years. Details at texancultures.utsa.edu.
This is The Source on Texas Public Radio, 89.1 FM. I'm David Martin Davies. We are in a pandemic. There's a highly contagious, deadly virus spreading in our community. People are getting sick. Some people are dying. It's estimated that by the first week of June, the national death tally for COVID-19 will hit 100,000. Meanwhile, people are squabbling over the requirement to wear a face mask in public. A hairdresser in North Texas is being hailed as a hero for breaking the law and opening shop. And over the skies of San Antonio, a small plane has been spotted with a banner that reads Chinese virus, a reaction to the city council's ordinance that calls that hate speech. This public health care crisis has become part of the culture war. What does this mean, and what does it mean for public policy making in the pandemic? How is this going to impact you, and how has it impacted you personally? What have you seen, and what would you like to see changed? What would you like to speak out about? Give us a call. The number is 833-877-8255, 833-TPR-TALK. Email us at thesource@tpr.org. We're joined by Scott Braddock, editor of the online political newsletter Quorum Report. He's the host of the Texas Take podcast. You could also catch him on Twitter at Scott Braddock. Scott, good to have you.
Good to be here, David.
Also with us, Robert Kahn, law professor at the University of St. Thomas. He has written about hate speech and its regulation. He's also studied attitudes towards face masks of Americans and what influences them. Professor Kahn, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me, David.
So, Scott Braddock, we were already planning to have this program when the culture war took another notch up yesterday with Attorney General Ken Paxton sending a letter to Bexar County, San Antonio, other counties, a few other counties, select counties in Texas, telling them what about their local virus rules.
Well, the Attorney General, the Republican AG, says that some of these local restrictions are, quote, unlawful and, quote, Orwellian. He was specifically talking about the rules in Austin and Travis County when he said Orwellian, as I was looking at his letters today. He sent letters to your folks there in San Antonio and Bexar County, as well as Travis County and Dallas County, which have been some of the most aggressive local governments in trying to crack down on the spread of this disease. The Attorney General saying a couple of things. One thing is that he says that because these local restrictions are in conflict with the governor's executive orders, that they are not legal and not enforceable. There is some constitutional question about that, which we can talk about more if you like. And then he's also simply saying that these things go too far when it comes to state law on how much fines can be, how much in fines can be levied against people. I think what you have in Bexar County is fines of up to $2,000 per violation on some of these things. For civil matters, state law says that the fines are around $1,000. So he might be on more sound footing on that. But when it comes to conflicting with the governor's executive orders, they might end up in court over that.
So it's interesting that the counties that were these letters went to were blue counties. Is that significant?
Well, it's certainly interesting. It certainly plays to what we have seen over the last few weeks here with the governor, the attorney general, and other Republican office holders targeting the leaders in areas that are run by Democrats. That includes Harris County, where Houston is as well. It was interesting that in some of these different communities where face masks had been required for weeks, it wasn't until the Democratic county judge in Harris County, Lena Hidalgo, who is a young, I think she's 29 years old, county executive who's a minority, a Latina, she went ahead and said they should have mandatory face masks in Houston. And that's when the lieutenant governor, the governor, and others spoke out against her, saying that that was sort of draconian and government overreach. And it really is the kind of politics that we see in Republican primaries in Texas, David, which is, this is sort of the muscle memory that Republican office holders in Texas have. That's where they go to first, is to attack Democrats. And, of course, you've probably seen the Lieutenant Governor Dan Patrick over and over again saying, at least in his estimation, the places that are handling this the worst, and he points to New York City and New York State, for example, he says that they're not dealing well in these places that are run by Democrats, and he includes local leadership in that as well.
Professor Kahn, since you've studied Americans' attitudes towards face masks, what do you see as, how do Americans feel about that?
I think there are two ways of looking at it. On the one hand, the pattern in Texas is followed in other places. There's certainly a sense that you see the Fox News crowd shifting on their opinion about masks as soon as it becomes, you know, a national political issue and Pence gets chided for not wearing a mask at the Mayo Clinic in Minnesota. What's interesting to me, though, is if you look at Massachusetts, where I'm from, and you have a Republican governor and Democratic towns, the Democratic towns pass mask laws like in Texas, but the Republican governor also enacted a mask statute that is a little bit less draconian. He did say that prosecutions would be rare, but left it open to the localities to enact some of their more serious penalties. So I do think that red and blue plays out differently in different places, but certainly the premise at the beginning of what you said about how mask wearing, the mask is a symbol. The mask is a symbol to say things aren't. Not wearing a mask is a symbol that says things are not that bad and maybe we can reopen. Yeah, I think there's some of that going on.
We hear that the requirement to wear a mask is a violation of someone's civil rights. I don't know if that's ever been litigated, but it seems to be something that people have spouted off without a whole lot of thought behind it. But is there anything behind that? Is there support for arguing that I have a civil right not to wear a mask in public during a pandemic?
Well, let's flip it around a little bit. There are a lot of laws that ban mask wearing, usually targeting the Ku Klux Klan, and those laws have gone up to the courts, and the courts have basically pretty uniformly over the past 15 or 20 years said no to mask wearers. There's no First Amendment right to wear a mask because the mask has no expressive quality independent of, say, a Ku Klux Klan outfit. Therefore, one really wonders how seriously the court would take a right to not wear a mask. Of course, it depends on the scope of the statute. A lot of the orders, New York, Massachusetts is this way, say, wear the mask and social distancing isn't. That, where social distancing is impossible, gives a little bit of wiggle room. But yeah, it hasn't been litigated. If red and blue exist at a state level, they certainly exist, you know, in a court level, and I wouldn't be surprised that different judges would have different attitudes about this.
Okay, but we also know that during a pandemic, a public health crisis, that there's a lot that the government can do or can require during normal times that would not be allowed. So the rules change. And we can talk about that when we come back from the break. We are having a conversation about the COVID-19 culture wars, about how attitudes that you have about the government, about political parties, about certain freedoms, you know, how that is going to impact how you feel about the virus and some of the responses that we have to trying to preserve life and flatten the curve and limit the spread of the coronavirus here locally. And we want to hear from you. This is really a public conversation. So call in, tell us what your thoughts are, what you have seen, what you want to see happening. The number is 833-877-8255, 833-TPR-TALK. This is The Source. We'll be right back. The This is The Source on Texas Public Radio, 89.1 FM. I'm David Martin Davies. We're talking about the culture wars and COVID-19 and how they are impacting the public policy making when it comes to responding to the spread of this virus. And you can join the conversation. The number is 833-877-8255, 833-TPR-TALK. And George is on the line. George, welcome to The Source. You're on the air.
Hey, would y'all please compare and contrast what Sweden is doing as opposed to the U.S.? Because Sweden seems to be doing just fine by not doing all these draconian measures that damage our economy and civil rights.
Okay, thank you for that. Professor Kahn, are you up to speed on what's going on in Sweden?
Yeah, I mean, Sweden is definitely taking a different course in terms of some of these lockdown measures. They've taken a slower course. In part, it's because the medical leadership in Sweden, the equivalent of our Dr. Fauci, felt that these lockdown measures were not as necessary. There has been a fair amount of voluntary closing down, which makes a difference. There's also some uneasiness in Sweden now about things. For a while, they absolutely were going, more slowly. I'll also throw in Denmark, where there are no bans on masks, no mask mandates whatsoever. The sense in Denmark is that if you require mask wearing, people are more likely to touch their face and they're less convinced of the medical necessity of that. You know, on the other hand, if you go to Germany, France, and Austria, they all require it. It's an open question. A pandemic is early. You don't know what's necessarily going to happen 3, 6, 9 months down the road, but the caller is absolutely right about Sweden taking a different approach.
But as of Monday, Sweden had registered 3,256 coronavirus-related deaths for its population size. That is considered to be high compared to its other its neighbors, which have enforced measures which are stricter than what Sweden imposed. So, and also, I understand Sweden has pretty good health care.
Yeah. I think that makes a difference. I also think one of the hardest things about the mask rules in particular is relationship between cause and effect. You can absolutely make an argument that if you're in a healthcare setting, a mask is a good thing to wear. It prevents you from spreading virus. The experience of mask wearing in Japan, it's a social norm. It protects society. It's like covering your mouth when you have a cold. There's common sense to it. But to prove that my wearing a mask while I'm going on a jog or walking in town is going to prevent a particular person from getting COVID is difficult. And that's what opens up this space for people to make arguments about masks and the lockdown.
And let's go to another caller, Ryan. Ryan, welcome to The Source. You're on the air.
Yeah, I guess my comment is that the hate speech ordinance that San Antonio just passed is pretty obviously unconstitutional. You know, the Supreme Court hasn't said anything different on that in decades. And to me, it's just begging for a lawsuit. You know, the first idiot with a megaphone to provoke the city into arresting them is going to have a slam dunk multi-million-dollar First Amendment lawsuit on their hands, and you know that's going to be paid for by the taxpayers. You know, not city council, not Mayor Nuremberg, by us. And I don't really care what people call the virus, but this is a big mismanagement of taxpayer funds to me.
All right, thank you for that. Let's go back to Professor Kahn. He's a law professor at the University of St. Thomas. San Antonio City Council declared that calling COVID-19, the Chinese virus, or some other forms of that which are derogatory, they label that as hate speech. Would that be, in and of itself, unconstitutional?
I'm not so sure. Hate speech is unconstitutional. You can't criminally punish hate speech, but I'm not sure the resolution does that. In the preamble, it does say all persons are encouraged to report any such anti-Semitic, discriminatory, or racist incidents. but that isn't enforced with any penalty, and there's no punishment mechanism. It seems like a declaratory statement. Someone could certainly try to challenge it, and I could see it, you know, lasting in court a little bit. The interesting thing about the statute is, why do you enact something that you're, you know, never going to enforce? I mean, it has a symbolic message, but to the extent, if the response is going to be this is going to lead to a First Amendment lawsuit, then on one level, you know, is the declaration doing what it really needs to be doing? And I wonder, but honestly, I don't see anything in the actual statute itself that punishes hate speech or has the fines or the other legal sanctions that would violate the First Amendment.
We do have an email. It's anonymous. My middle school son has been told by his classmates that they don't want to hang out with him because he's Asian and that he will give them the coronavirus. My son says it's a joke, but these kind of jokes are dangerous. And so Scott Braddock, editor of the online political newsletter QuorumReport.com, why is it important that we have, and this is coming from a sector of the political spectrum, that they want to label this the Chinese virus, not so much in trying to be hateful, but because what? What are they trying to do there?
Well, it's an us against them sort of thing. It's the kind of politics that President Trump has certainly been successful with. You may have seen that the president has not only gone out of his way to continue to talk about how this originated in China and call it the Chinese virus, et cetera, but you have seen where he wants to crack down on immigration even further. You see that he brags about cracking down on travel from China. At the same time, we know, the science tells us, that the big outbreak in New York came largely from travel from Europe, which was also restricted travel-wise, but it's not the one that the president puts the emphasis on. I would say this, the caller earlier was right. There will always be an idiot with a megaphone, for sure. But, you know, some of these things need to be litigated. Earlier it was asked, whether or not these mask restrictions would be considered to be constitutional. Other constitutional rights have been found by courts to be able to be at least curtailed on a temporary basis during a public health pandemic, including the right to an abortion in Texas. The Fifth Circuit upheld the state's temporary ban on that as this was playing out over the last couple of months.
Yeah, so to that point, a court ruled that the epidemic justified emergency measures that curtail constitutional rights so long as the measures have at least some real or substantial relation to the public health crisis. The court ruled that curtailing some constitutional rights are proper as long as this is dealing with the public health crisis. And that is directly from the 5th U.S. Circuit Court of Appeals decision that had ruled in favor of Texas's ban on abortion and that it should remain in place during the pandemic. And that was written by Judge Kyle Duncan, a Trump appointee. So, Professor Khan, it does look like, they're saying it's okay to limit constitutional rights during a pandemic.
They're saying it's okay to limit a woman's right to choose during a pandemic. And I don't know. I think that's probably right. And just to clarify what I said earlier, I do think, given the way mask bans have been basically tolerated, I think it's very likely that mask restrictions will be supported in many jurisdictions, particularly ones that are more broadly written. There are different lockdown measures. Some of them are more concerning, and I think people who are opposing some of the red state stuff make a mistake when they lump everything together. There are jurisdictions where they prohibit you from being more than a certain distance from your house during the lockdown. That feels a little bit iffy. some of the towns in Massachusetts have very elaborate rules about how to dispose of masks or any item that could be contaminated with COVID-19. And I guess what I'm trying to say is that the symbolism and fear run both ways.
Right.
We have a society that, like, this is a terrifying thing, and
which is why you would want scientists and, you know, public health officials to kind of make these decisions. Let's get Barbara in on this. Barbara has called in. Thanks for that. You're on the air, Barbara. Go ahead.
Yes, hi. I keep hearing the word draconian discussed here, and I'd just like to say that what is draconian is old white men deciding whether or not women can have an abortion and be in charge of their body. And I wonder if that is an ideological issue or a public health consideration, and I believe it to be an ideological. And tyranny is ripping children from the arms of their parents. Tyranny is expecting for people to work and not earn a living wage. And tyranny is not affording people health care. And it could just go on and on. Tyranny is the president that we have in the United States.
All right, Barbara, thank you for that. Scott Braddock. Abortion became part of this discussion when Governor Abbott put in his emergency declaration that bans on emergency procedures, on elective procedures would not be allowed. And then when that was relaxed, he still wouldn't allow abortions to move
right.
forward.
Well, and that's what tells you it was a culture war kind of thing. When the governor originally laid it out, as you said, it was about elective surgeries and about increasing capacity for other things, particularly COVID-19 care in our hospital systems. And what we have seen over the last couple of months in this state is that we have not seen our hospitals overrun. We have seen capacity be contained such that we do have enough beds for COVID-19 folks, which is one of the arguments for loosening up restrictions. I mean, the whole idea of flattening the curve was to ensure that we would have enough hospital capacity to take care of the patients that there are, and now the governor is saying we need to open things up. But when the question of abortion came up, he said that his new orders didn't have anything to do with that.
And Professor Kahn, back to you very quickly, on looking at this through the lenses of law, I mean, this is why can't this become just an easy call?
You mean about, can you just rephrase the question? I'm sorry.
Yeah, sure. But using law and trying to stick to the rule of law, you know, isn't that something that this is why we have the law in order to guide us when we do have emergencies, we know that we can count on the law to provide us, a way to proceed.
I think emergencies are the time when law is under the greatest amount of stress, when there are serious restrictions on rights and liberties. The Korematsu case involving the internment of 120,000 Japanese Americans, which was upheld by the Supreme Court. I mean, Korematsu is a common noun in legal parlance for an atrocious decision that restricts rights. And the question is how an individual court wants to make a judgment in an individual case. If you're talking about routine mask bans, I don't think they're going to, you know, be overturned. I think most courts are likely going to support lockdown orders. Again, to me, the interesting questions will come if we have a second wave and things get much worse. There's a person at the University of Minnesota, Osterholm, who basically predicts 60 to 70% of Americans will get infected no matter what we do. And, you know, in those kinds of situations where states are focusing on more extreme measures, yeah, I think that's a place where we want courts to step in and protect some measure of rights and liberties.
And we have the Court of Public Opinion, which apparently where there's a lot of action these days in the culture wars. What is happening with that court, and how is it dictating public policy? Is it putting us in the wrong direction? You can call in. The number is 833-877-8255, 833-TPR-TALK. We'll be right back.
evidence of an all-African-American combat unit in World War I was unearthed in the fields of France.
That this unit wasn't just any black unit. It was the underground command post of a unit called the Black Devils. That was the name the Germans gave them because of their fierceness in combat.
The Black Devils had ties to a pandemic. Their story on Fronteras. I'm Norma Martinez. Download Fronteras wherever you get your favorite podcasts.
Welcome back to The Source on Texas Public Radio, 89.1 FM. I'm David Martin Davies. This global pandemic could have been a unifying moment for the United States. It could have been this external enemy that we all have to come together in order to battle, but it has become a wedge issue. We're seeing where you are on the virus is also pretty much where you are on the political spectrum. Is not wearing a mask a political statement? How should elected officials balance civil liberties and public health and also the demands of the economy? Have you seen examples of how the pandemic response has become too politicized? Call in. We'd like to hear from you. The number is 833-TPR-TALK, 833-877-8255. So, Scott Braddock, I want to get back to this issue with Ken Paxton, the Texas Republican Attorney General, this letter that he sent cities, including San Antonio. San Antonio's response was from the mayor. It was that this is a cheap political headline. He didn't see this as something that was going to be, that had the weight of law behind it. Do you know what he means by that?
You were breaking up there. Who said that?
It was either the Mayor Nuremberg or County mm-hmm. Judge Nelson Wolf.
There are political headlines all around. The Attorney General in his letter is arguing that because these local restrictions are in conflict with what the governor has laid out in his executive orders, that they don't have the force of law. Something that I would like to point out from these executive orders that the governor included in the language when he issued them is this, that he said that he was suspending the parts of Texas law that allow for mayors and county judges to suppress disease. All right. This may need to go to court because I don't see in the Texas Constitution where the governor can do that. This is what the Constitution says about suspension of laws, and it's pretty succinct, David. It says, quote, suspension of laws. No power of suspending laws in this state shall be exercised except by the legislature. It doesn't say that the governor can do that. Now, there was a statute that was passed that has to do with disaster powers that the governor is hanging his hat on here, where he's saying that he can do certain things when there is a public health disaster that's been declared for certain parts of the state, or in this case, all parts of the state. But I have heard from Republican lawmakers, I mean, you're talking about Democratic leadership there in San Antonio, but some Republican lawmakers have told me that they're very concerned that the governor is overstepping his authority constitutionally. You know that when the county judge, for example, will enact an emergency order to try to deal with some kind of crisis in the community, they still have to get the okay from county commissioners about that. I think it's after 7 days. And some Republicans have said that maybe the governor ought to be similarly constrained, that maybe he should be able to act, put forth certain orders like he has done here, and then after maybe a month or 90 days, he would have to call on the Texas legislature to say yes or no to what he's doing. When they first said that the governor could have these emergency powers, nobody envisioned that this would go on for months and months, if not years, because who knows how long this pandemic is going to go on. When the Disaster Act was passed years ago, they figured that what he'd be dealing with would be things like, hurricanes, wildfires, and things like that, that are generally, you know, the response to that is, or at least the emergency response is over within a month or 6 weeks.
And Professor Robert Kahn, law professor at University of St. Thomas, what about emergency powers that governors have or the president? Does the situation that we have now with this pandemic, although it's almost become normalized in some ways, and they want everyone to go back to work and they want it to be normal, but at the same time they want to hang on to their emergency powers. Does it cut both ways?
I agree with what Scott Braddock said. When these powers were enacted, nobody thought about emergency powers lasting this long. People, the emergency power sections of statutes and the constitutional issues are things that people normally don't forget, don't think about in happier times. I will say that I think the constitutional issue that he brought up is a serious one, and the ability of a state to basically strip localities of their ability to undertake any kind of action in response to an emergency seems pretty broad, and certainly that it's done based on the governor alone is a pretty strong statement as well. So I'm actually, really shocked about that. And, that's where what you said earlier about law is so important, in that you have judges who actually hold people to standards. So I think this really is a serious issue that merits watching as the pandemic goes on.
The number is 833-877-8255, 833-TPR-TALK. Do you think that these emergency powers that have been obtained by the governor and others, should they be limited? Have they gone too far? Or are you comfortable with how they're handling things thus far? I do have an email from Julie. The political beliefs held by my husband and I differ greatly from many of our family. In the past, we just held our tongue most of the time to keep the peace, and it worked until now. My husband has diabetes, so we're being extra cautious and don't know how we can visit our children safely without a vaccine, at least until that comes, about maybe at least a year away. Our families mostly seem to think that we are stooges for the left, which I conflate with sound science, and now they're getting really impatient, even angry, and I can't even hold my tongue until this blows over or leaves or leave the room. So this is driving a wedge between us like nothing else. Meanwhile, so she says, I want to cry how bad this has become. Scott Braddock with the Texas Take podcast and the Quorum Report. This is tearing families apart.
It is, and tearing them apart at a moment when they can't get away from each other. it's I get why she's crying, and I've heard examples of this here in Austin and around the state. People very upset with each other about the way it's playing out, because it has real world consequences. Look at the way that the governor originally laid out a plan that was tailored to big business. It was structured such that smaller businesses would probably have to continue to stay closed. You remember that when the governor laid this out on April 27th in Texas, he had said that restaurants, for example, would be able to open at 25% capacity. Most restaurant owners, especially small ones, will tell you that they can't make any money that way, and so a lot of them just still staying closed. But what happened as soon as there was political pressure brought on the governor over the case of one hair salon owner in Dallas? I know you've reported on this on TPR. Shelley Luther, up in Dallas County, had defied the governor's order, said that she was going to go ahead and open her hair salon, even though that was not allowed yet. And by the way, under the original plan, David, it wouldn't be allowed yet even now. I mean, they weren't even going to look at that until the 18th, coming up next week. But there were Republican state representatives, conservative grassroots activists, what I would call some AstroTurf activists as well, groups like the Convention of States group, Empower Texans, Texas Right to Life, and some others that were protesting against the governor. There were some legislators who also got some professional haircuts defying the governor on all of this. Right-wing politics came to bear. And while the governor has been talking about doctors and data driving all of his decisions, I can't see where the doctors and data changed at all. It was the politics that changed. And the governor basically folded like a cheap suit and went ahead and green-lighted those hair salons opening. And they did legal gymnastics to get that woman out of jail in Dallas, even though she was clearly in violation of the order and was also in contempt of court. That's why she was actually jailed. She got out of jail. And in the meantime, I know you've reported on this, that so many people are so charged up about all this, so many people are fired up about this, about the idea that the government is somehow overreaching by keeping certain businesses closed. It was a GoFundMe account set up for her, and she made off with, I think, about $500,000 in that GoFundMe account while she was getting money from the PPP program. So she cleaned up real nice. But it was all driven by this divisive politics that's even dividing those people in that house.
Also, we've got a tweet from that was a retweet from President Trump calling for the removal of that judge. And so Professor Khan, law professor, University of St. Thomas, the interference of the executive from here in Texas, Governor Abbott, and also President Trump on this case about obeying the executive order that was given by the governor, it seems that we're getting mixed messages about who the laws apply to. We had two women from Laredo, Latinas, who were also dealt, you know, were fined and jailed for this. And then, but the one they care about is the woman in North Texas.
I mean, I agree. And I think about this from a national perspective, and you look at a sense that in, say, New York, some of the shutdown orders are applied disproportionately against people of color. And there's a real sense about, you know, who is privileged to break these orders and who isn't. And I mean, you know, from my understanding of the science, what you're looking at using cell phone data is the percentage of people who aren't on the subway or aren't going places or aren't doing things. And to some extent, you know, that goes to, if you can encourage, do you need to enforce? And it also raises, I also really empathize with the woman who emailed, and, you know, it is a danger of, you know, politicizing this and thinking that every time I wear a mask or don't wear a mask, if I really want to open my business, it's because I'm in league with the right wingers, as opposed to just really not having a job, not having an income. I do think there's a lot of profiteering by professional, you know, Patriots of America Tea Party types to kind of, you know, build on this. I don't see how you can look at the people in California who wear a Klan mask and a swastika while shopping, you know, in any other way. There's nothing about liberty or freedom that requires that. It's about sending a message, and a very deliberate one.
When we come back from this break, we'll talk about whether or not these organizations are trying to use these issues related to trying to protect the public during the COVID-19 crisis as a way to rile up their base, particularly we are 6 months away from the general election. This is The Source on Texas Public Radio. You can call in at 833-877-8255, 833-TPR-TALK. We'll be right back. Welcome back to The Source on Texas Public Radio, 89.1 FM. I'm David Martin Davies. We're talking about the culture wars and COVID-19. Got a couple of emails, one from John. San Antonio's hate speech ordinance was actually a resolution, and that it did not have, and it was not binding and is not any kind of First Amendment restriction. Another email from Jim, calling it the Wuhan or the Chinese virus, is simply giving credit where credit is due. No one is blaming Asian Americans. I don't see widespread increase in harassment of any Chinese or Asian population. And so this is San Antonio City Council is absurdly out of touch. There is documented evidence of a increase in harassment and persecution against Chinese Americans, Asian Americans in the United States. But to the point of John saying that this is just not legally binding, it's a resolution. So Professor Khan, I mean, can't the city council just try and say, we want everyone to know that we find that to be offensive and we declare it hate speech and that's that?
That was pretty much my interpretation of the statute. What makes it a little more complicated is one of the whereases, part of the preamble, does talk about investigating people. And even though that's not binding either, it gives people who want to pursue this argument a little bit of a hook. I also think there's a difference between saying COVID-19 originated in Wuhan, China, that, and calling it the Kung Fu virus. It also, or mentioning Wuhan where it doesn't make sense, given the rise of attacks on Asian Americans, honestly, a resolution like this seems relatively harmless. It doesn't really seem to, you know, feel that out of touch at all.
Why can't we call it the Trump virus? Since it happened under his watch, he seemed to drop the ball in trying to handle it, and he loves to slap his names on things. Scott Braddock, is taking this name Chinese virus, is that important?
It is significant. If you think about the other viruses that we know by their place names, it hasn't been controversial. Think about the Zika virus, think about the West Nile virus, etc. People will often talk about how the Spanish flu was named for Spain, even though it didn't originate there, it was discovered there. But when it comes to this virus, this has become a point of contention. And if you look at the political reality, it's not just Republicans who are doing that. The Joe Biden campaign, who is the presumptive nominee for the Democratic Party, he's been running some, at least ads on the Internet, I don't know if they've been on television just yet, in which he has been attacking President Trump for not being tough enough on China when it comes to this virus. So at least from the Democratic standpoint, it sounds like they're going to at least litigate part of this election based on who would be the toughest in dealing with China when it comes to this virus. It's not something that is a strictly partisan thing.
Scott Braddock, one of the big issues that's a spinoff from this is the question about mail-in voting. The concern is that if we have to vote in person during the coming up runoff for the primary and then also the November election, we could be exposing many people to the virus and spread the virus, and that there's a call in a legal battle to have mail-in voting as an option for individuals, and that is split along party lines as well, right?
It is. Democrats say that if you think that you might catch the COVID-19 disease, that you might catch the coronavirus if you go vote in person, if you're fearful of that, then you should qualify for a mail-in ballot. Republicans point to the state law that says there are certain disabilities which qualify you for that ballot, and that being afraid of catching a disease is not one of them. Republicans would like to stick to what the state law says currently. There was a judge in Travis County, a state district court judge, that ruled in favor of the Democrats and said that everybody in Texas ought to be able to get a mail-in ballot if they want one. And this, of course, has ramped up even further as a partisan battle. There were a couple of Democratic activists in Dallas, you may have seen. They filed a criminal complaint against the Attorney General, Ken Paxton, because he had sent out a letter to elections administrators telling them not to mislead people about who qualifies for a mail-in ballot. These activists in Dallas County, they filed this criminal complaint with the Democratic District Attorney there, John Cruzo, and said that it's fraud for the Attorney General to mislead those elections administrators. So again, there's a lot of confusion about there, you know, out there, and I think, you know, a lot of folks have simply said, you know, why don't people just go ahead and request a mail-in ballot and see how it goes at this point? We've got a runoff on July 14th, as you know, and then of course the general election coming up in November.
But the thing is, whether or not Texas flips blue or not could depend on the outcome of whether or not mail-in voting is easily accessible, Scott. I mean, that's maybe why there's so much energy here.
There may be some something to that. Right now, it's as one consultant said to me, elections are still, as much as we've heard about youth voting and the energy, you know, among young voters, it's still, as this person put it, the battle of the old people. In Harris County, Texas, so the largest county population-wise, average voter is still over 60 years old. That's both Democrats and Republicans. Over 65 qualify for mail-in ballots anyway. There is a thought that if Democrats can get more voter participation through mail-in balloting, then they can flip some of these seats in the Texas House and potentially give John Cornyn a run for his money in the general election in the U.S. Senate race. And, of course, we still don't have a nominee on the Democratic side just yet. M.J. Hager, who ran for Congress back in 2018 unsuccessfully, and a state senator from Dallas, Royce West, are facing off in that runoff July 14th.
Let me just bottom line it really quickly. If you are 65 or older on Election Day, you should put in for a mail-in ballot. Right now, we know you can get one, and that'll probably make your life a lot easier if you do that. Disinformation has been a big part of this culture war. Is that something that you have detected, Professor Khan?
I think people have different versions of facts. There's a tendency, I mean, there's a lot of uncertainty, and there's a tendency towards minimalization of the scope of COVID-19, comparing it to a flu. That was part of the first couple months of the Trump administration's public response. I'm not saying they were doing that privately, you know, a concern about protecting the markets. And there's a real balancing act between having about something and public health risk. I mean, it's very similar to me to some of the arguments around climate change.
Yeah, so Scott Braddock, you keep a close eye on some of these AstroTurf groups. Explain what that is and what are you reading, what are you seeing in regards to trying to push certain informational talking points which are not really related to reality?
Well, there are grassroots conservatives and then there are the AstroTurf groups, and I'd like to make that distinction. There are folks who are simply very conservative in their politics and very upset about certain policies. And then there are the grifters. There are those who would like to profit off of that. I'm talking about groups like Empower Texas, Texas Right to Life, etc. And they were some of those that were protesting and making the most noise about the hair salon owner in Dallas when, you know, you had hair salon owners all over the state of nearly 29 million people, 254 counties and two time zones. You think the only hair salon owner who had run into financial trouble was this one woman in Dallas? This was, you know, a pretty sophisticated political operation to try to change the policy that we were following in Texas, and the governor acquiesced. He did exactly what they asked, which is to go ahead and open all those hair salons all over the state, and that, of course, has nothing to do with data and doctors. So when we talk about misinformation being out there, it's out there in spades. We had reported first at QuorumReport.com that what the governor had said in a private conversation in a conference call with lawmakers, which did not include media, but there was leaked audio from the conference call, he had said, quote, "It's ipso facto, the more you have people out there, the greater the possibility there is for transmission." Basically, he was saying, the more you open businesses, the more cases of this disease you're going to see. And publicly, David, he had said that you're going to see increased numbers of COVID-19 because of increased testing. But that's different from what he said in that private conversation, which is a basic acknowledgement that as you open up business, like those hair salons and other businesses where they touch you, there's a difference between going to the grocery store where, you know, if they touch you at the grocery store, David, it's probably because something wrong is happening, probably asking you to leave the premises or something. But if you go to a hair salon, barbershop, et cetera, they are physically touching you, which when we're talking about transmission of a disease is, of course, significant. And the governor acknowledged in that private conversation that if they open those businesses, there will be more of this disease. And it's not just because of an increase in testing is why you're seeing those increased numbers.
And Scott Braddock, as we get closer to Election Day, will voters be voting on how well they see how this crisis has been handled? We see polling data that shows the majority of people think that we should slow down the opening of these businesses. And if we see an increase in the number of the outbreak, people catching the virus and dying from the virus, will the Republican leadership be held accountable?
The question that keeps coming up is, what will we know about this in October that we don't know today? And, of course, nobody knows the answer to that. But to your point, the voters are going to be judging elected leadership, whether it's Democrats in Democratic states or Republicans in Republican states like this one. People will be judging them based on how they handle this crisis. People don't even almost remember anymore that the president was impeached, and that was this year. And now we're only talking about COVID-19 and the response to it. If it's judged to be a success, those politicians will be rewarded. If not, Katie bar the door.
All right. I want to thank both of our guests. That is Scott Braddock, the editor of the online political newsletter, QuorumReport.com. Say hi to Harvey for me, Scott Braddock.
We will.
And he's also the host of the Texas Take podcast, and you can find that wherever you get your podcast. He's on Twitter at Scott Braddock. Also with us is Robert Kahn, the law professor at the University of St. Thomas, and he is an expert on hate speech and its regulations, and he's been studying attitudes of Americans towards face mask. And Professor Kahn, thank you for everything this afternoon. And this is The Source on Texas Public Radio. Thank you for tuning us in.
This has been The Source on Texas Public Radio. The Source is hosted by David Martin Davies, produced by Kim Johnson and Dallas Williams, with production assistance provided by me, Ruben Garcia. Dan Katz is TPR's news director. Support for The Source comes from contributors to the Community Engagement Fund, including the Gladys and Ralph Lazarus Foundation.